It's good to have everybody with our study on the book of Revelation. And I am excited as I know how to be of this study. It's been very helpful to me, and I hope that it's helpful to you. The more I study from the book of Revelation, the more encouraged I think that we all can be that the Lord is in control and there's not anything going to happen that's going to be greater than he is. Now, in our study tonight, I want to do two things. I'd like to get well into the 12th chapter, but in order to do that, I think it's absolutely crucial that we recap, and there's our word, Richard, the things that we find in the first 11 chapters, because the first 11 chapters state the case. Here we see what's taking place. In beginning in chapter 12, we see the why. And so that's what we're going to be discussing tonight. But to recap just a little bit, we start in the first chapter and we read that these are things which are the revelation of Jesus Christ, chapter 1, verse 1, that are signified unto John by the angel, and they are to be written down. They can be understood. He says, blessed is he that readeth, verse 3, and they that hear the words of the prophecy and keep the things which are written therein, for the time is at hand. Now, that tells us something, that the book of Revelation is not some kind of an obscure book that nobody knows what it means, or that it is just filled with signs and symbols that cannot be identified and has no significance or meaning to those who would read the book. Obviously, those who would read the book, including you, including me, we can benefit from the things that are revealed within it. And if we ever lose sight of that and think that it's pertaining to things that nobody can understand, then here we have an inspired book instructed unto John to be recorded for those who would read it, instructed to understand it and obey it, that we can't understand and can't obey. And that's just foolishness. That's a reflection upon God. We note that in the fourth verse beginning, we are introduced unto the glory of Christ, from whom this book comes. We noted in verse 11 that it's addressed to the seven churches of Asia Minor, not signifying that there were only seven or that only these seven had need to read it, but the problems and things that these would face would be typical of all, and thus the letter would be beneficial to all. We noted as the description of Christ continues in verses 17 and 18, Jesus said, fear not, I am the first and the last, the living one, and I was dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys of death and Hades. And then he tells John, write the things that you see. Now, in chapters 2 and 3, we're going to have occasion to come back and revisit these chapters, but simply to note that the Lord knew what these churches were doing. He knew the circumstances that they were in. He knew the things that they were lacking in, the things that they were not doing. And we see that discussed in chapters 2 and chapter 3. Chapters 4 and 5 go together because here we see the throne of God in heaven. And we noted in chapter 4 that the 4 and 20 angels, or the 4 and 20 elders, and the four living creatures, I tried to get that turned around, the four living creatures and the 24 elders are singing praises of glory unto God because of his omnipotence and because of his role in creation. And then in the 5th chapter, John is sad because there is a book that seems to answer the questions that he would have, but he doesn't know that there is anyone qualified to open the book and to reveal the contents. And he's told not to weep, that there is one, verse 5, of the tribe of David, of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, that is overcome and is worthy to open the book. Some have written, well, Ray Summers has written a book called Worthy is the Lamb, and that comes from this chapter as far as the title is concerned. And we know that this Lamb is worthy to reveal the contents. And then we see the four living creatures and the 24 elders singing a new song, Worthy Art Thou to Take the Book, verse 9, and to open the seals thereof. And then we see the voice of many angels, and then 10,000 times 10,000s and thousands of thousands in verse 11, giving praises unto the Lamb, verse 12, for his role of overcoming and revealing the contents of the book. And then in the conclusion of the fifth chapter, once again, the four living creatures and the 24 elders giving praise unto the Lamb and to God. Now in chapter 6, the text begins with, I saw when the Lamb opened the one of the seven seals. So here we have the opening of the seals, and we have the appearance of various horses and their riders, indicating judgment that was to come and prompting the question of verse 17 by John, that who is able to stand when the wrath of God, the day of God's wrath, is come. And then in the seventh chapter, we saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth. Essentially, they are restrained until the sealing of God's people, the 144,000, that is, God would protect these people that belonged to him. Now, one of the things that we noted in that does not mean that God's people would not suffer or that some of them would not die. But the point is established that judgment would be withheld until such time as they were sealed. And then beginning in the eighth chapter, we see the resuming of the opening of the seventh seal in chapter 8, verse 1, followed by a period of silence. And we talked about that. We noted in verses 3 through verse 5, that God hears and God answers prayers. And then we studied concerning the sounding of the seven trumpets in Revelation chapter 8, beginning in verse 6. And that thought continues postponed, I guess would be a good word, for verse 13, when he says, woe, woe, woe for them that dwell on the earth, by reason of the other voices of the trumpet of the three angels who are yet to sound. So we have this pause and identifying that what has happened is bad, but what's to come is much worse. And then chapter 9, beginning in verse 1, we have the fifth angel sounding, the locusts that are set forth, and then the sixth angel sounds in verse 13. And we noted in that context, once again, consequences as the four angels that are bound at the great river Euphrates are loosed, verse 15. Then beginning in chapter 10, we have yet another interlude in the discussion, where we are introduced to another strong angel. And before this angel is a little book opened, as opposed to a book that was closed in chapter 5, sealed with the seven seals. This book is open, and John hears the voice of seven thunders. And we note in regard to these things that an angel said, don't write these things. So we don't know what that indicates. No, it's not revealed. But then in verse 7 of chapter 10, I think a very key verse if you are big on key verses, but it's telling because it tells us that the days of the voice of the seventh angel when he is about to sound, then is finished the mystery of God. And we talked about that from Daniel chapter 7, where there were good tidings that were declared to his servants, the prophets. And I believe those good tidings had to do with the judgment of the tormentors of God's people. And again, we call your attention to go back and read and read and reread Daniel chapter 7 and see who is being identified by Daniel in chapter 7 as the tormentors of God's people that would be judged. Now, in verses 9 and following, we are introduced to a little book. And I'm frankly persuaded that this little book that was to be digested and then applied, that this little book contains further prophecy that is indicated in chapter 12, essentially, and following. Now, chapter 11 becomes very crucial to our understanding, somewhat of a conclusion of the things that we've been talking about. For John is instructed to arise and measure the temple of God, the altar, and them that worship therein. Now, I noted that it's not my conviction that John is instructed to measure the actual temple in the city of Jerusalem because John was not in Jerusalem. John was exiled on the Isle of Patmos. We compared this to the measuring of the temple by Ezekiel, and we noted that Ezekiel was not in Jerusalem either. He was a captive in Babylon, but he was instructed to measure the temple. Again, not the literal temple in the city of Jerusalem, for their presence was not there. And we also wanted to note that in the 11th chapter, we are introduced to two witnesses, and they would prophesy 1,260 days in sackcloth. Now, we noted that that is not a definitive amount of time, that you go one day beyond that. No, we're not talking about a definitive amount of time, but simply to identify here a brief period of time of turmoil and persecution. And we looked at that in Daniel chapter 7, and we'll look at it some more because this expression is used a number of times in Scripture. And we noted that these two witnesses would prophesy, and then the beast would come out of the abyss and overtake them and kill them. And their dead bodies would lie in the streets. And it would appear that the beast has been victorious over the witnesses until the witnesses stood on their feet. And then they continued to prophesy. And the point being then is that what appeared to be a victory for the beast was not a victory at all. And then we read in the 14th verse that the second woe is past and the third woe comes quickly. And then in verse 15, the seventh angel sounded and there followed great voices in heaven. And they said, the kingdom of the world is become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. Now, we took that thought back to Daniel 2 and back to Daniel 7, verse 14, Daniel 7, verse 25 through 27, and noted that the things that were prophesied by the Old Testament prophet Daniel was not to be interrupted by the rulership of any man. And then in verses 16 through really the end of the chapter, we're told about the 24 elders who sit before God on their thrones and how that they fell on their faces and worshiped God. And you'll notice in this statement, verse 17 and 18, let's read it, saying, we give thanks, O Lord God, the Almighty, who art and who wast, because thou was taken or hast taken thy great power and didst reign. And the nations were wroth, and thy wrath came, and the time of the dead to be judged, and the time to give their reward to thy servants, the prophets, and to the saints, and to them that fear thy name, the small, the great, and to destroy them that destroy the earth. Now, we took that thought back to Psalms chapter 2. Remember, as we talked about the nations being ravaging or wroth or angry, and we discussed that as a matter of prophecy from Psalms chapter 2. And we noted that this is not discussing any kind of final judgment, but God's judgment upon those who would punish and persecute the people of God. And then in verse 19, there was opened the temple of God that is in heaven. And there was seen in his temple the Ark of the Covenant. And there followed lightnings and voices and thunders and an earthquake and great hail. Now, we noted the voice of lightnings and thunders and great hail and earthquake, and all of that indicates that God was paying attention. We saw that earlier in our, which chapter was it? Chapter 8, verse 5, as we discussed that there. And the point being of the Ark of the Covenant and the temple that is in heaven indicates the presence of God. Now, having said all of that, and we didn't look at, and perhaps we should have, against the backdrop of persecution and the saints crying out under the altar, how long does this continue? How long does this persecution go on? Do you know how long? In reading these first 11 chapters, do you know how long this persecution would last? Do you know that it would not last indefinitely? Do you know that? Do you know that God's judgment would come to play and this persecution upon God's people would one day cease? Do you know that Christ and his church would be victorious by the time you get to the end of chapter 11? Now, if you know that, you're ahead of the hounds, because that's what these first 11 chapters are to teach us, that Christ and his church will win. there's not going to be any persecution that's going to punish the church right out of existence. Not going to happen. Now, when you begin with chapter 12, you're beginning with a second section of the book of Revelation. But if you'll notice that, here's some of the resources, just some of the resources that I've been studying. If you're interested in that, it's on our website. You're welcome to go to any of that and read a great deal of information that might be helpful to you. But here's what we just discussed from the review of the chapters. Now, beginning in chapter 12, here's the backdrop against which the first 11 chapters lay. What's been going on that has been causing persecution against God's people? Did it just drop out of the sky for no reason, or was there a reason for the church to be persecuted? Well, chapters 12 and following tell us about that and what the reason is. We notice in chapter 12 through chapter 14, there's the discussion of the woman, the dragon, and the man-child, the war that takes place. In chapters 15 through 16, we're going to be studying about the bowls of wrath, the fall of Babylon, the harlot, in chapters 17 and 18, the victory, ultimate victory of God's people, chapters 19 through 21, and then warnings that you're familiar with in chapter 22. This, I think, helps us, this chart, because it demonstrates something for us. It helps us to see in the first 11 chapters what's going on among God's people on earth. And chapters 12 through 22 answers the question, why? What's going on behind the scenes? And so we're going to look at that. Here again, you see the same comparison, chapters 1 through 11. We know when we come to chapter 11 that the church is going to be victorious. Nothing's going to defeat it. But in chapters 12 through 22, we see the vantage point of heaven to note that Satan and all of his compadres are not going to overcome God. Not going to defeat God's purpose. Now, here's a brief outline of the things that we're going to be looking at in the 12th chapter. The woman, the dragon, and the male child. Now, needless to say, we're going to do our best to try to identify these, who they are, and it will be helpful to us. We'll see the introduction of this war in heaven beginning in verse 12, the persecution of the woman and the protection of her in verses 13 through verse 17, the persecution of the woman and those who come from her in verses 13 through 17. Now, verse 17, again, I will note, I am not big on key passages because that kind of sounds like the others aren't as important as these are. But I think these do help us somewhat to create a milestone, a landmark of the things that we're talking about. In verse 17 of chapter 12, now I know that's the end of the chapter, so we're jumping ahead, but notice it says the dragon waxed wroth, enraged, Randy, the New American Standard Translation, says with the woman and went away to make war with the rest of her seed. Well, this is going to be important as we develop this through the chapter. And the rest of her seed is identified in the latter part of that expression that keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus. Now, that's helpful to us. Make a note of that. We're going to be coming back to it periodically. Now, at first, I didn't know that I wanted to use this chart, but I've decided that I did want to include it because the question, what is the point, becomes a relative question in the discussion of this chapter because it introduces the rest of the book. We see that the war has been engaged ultimately against Christ, and we're going to see where that began. Not just at his birth, but it certainly involved that. Not just at his death, but it certainly involved that. But then we see that this battle continued to be with those who were his people and are his people. And so we want to discuss that, and you'll note that this is all a discussion of a battle with God and Satan. And we'll see the various, what I will call phases of that as we go along. Now, this is some artist concept, and I think it is helpful only to get an image in your mind of what John saw. He saw a great dragon. He saw the heads of the dragons and the horns on a great tail. And so this just simply magnifies for us the horribleness of what John saw. Now, when we get into the development of this, again, to recap, Richard, I like that word a lot better than the other word. We see the church's conflict in the world And that's what John is presented in chapters 1 through 11, particularly the question in chapter 6, beginning in verse 9, how long is this going to go on? But there's something behind this, brethren, and that is this struggle that has been going on for a long, long time. And that's what's discussed in chapters 12 through 22. And so this is the beginning of what we're calling part 2 of the apocalypse. This part focuses on the sins of what I'm convinced is the Roman Empire and how complete its overthrow would be during this time of oppression and persecution of God's people. Again, Revelation was written to recap, and Richard, you help me with that word, because it helps us to see that the facts are stated, the conclusion is offered, and then we go back and we see the reasons why. And I think that's what John is doing. In chapter 11, he offers to us the conclusion. And then in chapters 12 following, he offers us the reasons why. So we shouldn't look at the book of Revelation as something that is written per chapter in chronological order. Here's what unfolds or develops. And I think that's how so many read it. And that's why they come to the conclusion of the book with some kind of futuristic interpretation that the book is designed to tell us what's going to happen at the end of time. That's not the purpose of the book. The book is written to help us to see that God and his people will be victorious. Now that's what it's about. Now, part one tells us about what Rome was doing in persecution against God's people. Now, I know there's a debate as to what extent the Roman rulers persecuted the church. I think it can be fairly well established, not that it was possible, but that it did in fact. In fact, there were more than just one of the Roman rulers that persecuted Christians. And I think you'll find historically that it was Constantine, the Roman ruler, who made a proclamation that brought much of that to a close. And he thought that if he could get people to have the kind of commitment that he saw in Christians, have that kind of commitment to him, then that would be a big plus for his reign. So he ceased the persecution of God's people. But be that as it may, what we want to see is that God has offered time for those who were tormenting God's people to stop doing that. And obviously that did not occur until God intervened and they stopped doing that. And so we're going to be looking at some of that as we discuss in the 11th chapter or the 12th chapter. Very quickly, just through these slides, we see that we're assured that the final outcome is to be Christians would win. God and his people will win. We saw that in the last few verses of chapter 11. Characters are introduced, the beast versus God's witnesses. We saw that also in chapter 11. The winners are announced, Christ and his saints. Now here's what remains to be answered. Why did this hostility begin to start with? And from whence comes the power that motivates? What's behind this persecution of God's people? And I think that sets the stage to be answered in chapters 12 and following. We'll just pass beyond this. We've already talked about that. But I do have to ask these questions. Does the struggle involve just the church in Rome? No, that's not all there is to it. There's something behind it. And that's where we begin with chapter 12. And in chapter 12, verse 1, look at your Bible or you can look at the screen. The verses are from the American Standard Translation that you see quoted here. And a great sign was seen in heaven, a woman arrayed with the sun, the moon under her feet, and upon her head, a crown of 12 stars. Now, I know that some have tried to make the argument of the sunlight period, the moonlight period, and the starlight period of the revelation of God's plan to redeem. I don't believe that's what's implied here. I think it's simply discussing the radiance of the woman, the importance that is attached to the woman. And in verse 2, it tells us that she was with child, and she cried out, travailing in birth and in pain to be delivered. And then where did all this begin? Well, look with me, if you will, all the way back to Genesis chapter 3. Wasn't that one of the first Bible verses that you were called upon to memorize? Well, there's a reason for that. We know in the book of Genesis, in chapter 1, chapter 2, we read about the creation account. chapter 3, we read about the introduction of sin, and then we read of the consequences of sin. And when God is speaking to the serpent in verse 15, it says, "And I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. He shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel." Now, I don't know how many Bible classes I've taught and introduced this verse with this comment. If this was all we had, I wouldn't have the slightest idea what the writer is talking about. But you see, we have the rest of the Bible to explain verse 15 of chapter 3 for us. Sin has been introduced by the serpent, the devil, in this temptation of Eve here in the beginning. And God said to the serpent, "I will put enmity," that is hostility. Some translations render hatred, "between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed." And then I like to emphasize, "He," that is the seed of woman, "will bruise thy head, and thou," that is the devil, "shall bruise his heel." Now, how many Bible studies have we tried to explain this verse by pointing to the scheme of redemption that Satan would seem to have gained the victory when Christ was crucified on the cross? But he did not remain dead. On the third day, according to the word of the prophets, he was raised from the dead. And you see that in Revelation chapter 1, verse 18. Christ is the one that holds the keys of death and Hades. He was raised from the dead. He has authority over death. He has authority over Hades. Now, in our text, this particular woman, note her appearance. She is described as one that is clothed with the sun, the moon is under her feet, and the heavenly bodies that rule the day and the night are a part of her crown. Now, as you'll look at that very carefully, what do we learn about the appearance of this woman? Richard, I know this is a whole lot of your particular likes when you start to talk about word studies. Word studies can be so helpful. The word translated crown in this passage is from the word stephanos, a very interesting word. It's not used of a kingly crown that somebody might have simply because of their position or their prestige, but rather it is used to describe the victory crown. Now, we can read in the epistles of Paul speaking of that many run in a race, but one receives the crown. Here's what we're talking about, the victory crown. Satan never wears in the scriptures such a crown. This woman does. Tells us something about this woman in her appearance. All the grandeur, all the splendor that surrounds her is presented here in this 12th chapter as John sees this vision. Now let's go back to Revelation chapter 12. Revelation chapter 12. As we further describe this woman, you'll note the sun and the moon and the stars that are a part of her appearance. Throughout the scriptures, light has been used to represent righteousness. It's been used multiple times by John, and those of you in our Wednesday night class know that this last Wednesday night, we talked about many instances in the Gospel of John and in the epistles of John, where John talks about the importance of light. We talked about those who walk in the light. They have fellowship with God. Those who walk in darkness and claim that they've committed no sin, they lie and do not the truth. So light, truth, righteousness, these are all qualities or characteristics of this woman. Now, I want to suggest to you that when you're studying with somebody who believes that the book of Revelation is pointed to the second coming of Christ and the events that are going to take place on the earth at that time, have some difficulty with the presentation of the appearance of this woman. What we've called the futurist interpreters who believe that Revelation is to point to things at the second coming of Christ have a problem when it comes to this passage. It's impossible to clothe the woman with the sun, the moon, and the 12 stars when all of this is to be destroyed. If this is understood figuratively, however, now Harkrider makes an interesting comment on this. He said, then these heavenly bodies that rule the day and night symbolize her exalted position in God's order of things. And I think that's consistent with the use of those terms in both New and Old Testament history. Now, as we further look at this woman, she's with child. Verse 2 tells us she's about to give birth. She's travailing in pain, about to be delivered. Who is the woman? Isn't that the question that everybody wants to answer? Who is the woman? Some say, well, that's Mary. Some say, well, that's the Jewish nation. Others say, well, no, that's the church that's the woman. And I think there's problems with all of those views. The woman is not a literal woman any more than the dragon is a literal dragon. We're not talking about Mary. We notice also that from woman comes the man-child, verse 5. And though that be Mary that gave physical birth to Jesus, that's not the literal woman or a literal woman discussed in this passage. This passage is not talking about a literal woman. I want to notice as well, he's not talking about the nation of Israel as a whole. Now listen carefully. I know there are some that take the position that the woman of this passage is the nation of Israel. I want you to think about the components of the nation of Israel. We know that not all of Israel served God. The reason that the Assyrian captivity came upon the nation of Israel was because they were rebelling against God. The reason the Babylonian captivity came upon the southern kingdom was they were rebelling against God. And if you'll notice in Zechariah chapter 11 in verses 10 through verse 13, a very powerful passage, I'm convinced. Well, let's just turn to it and read it. Because this Old Testament passage talks with us about a time when national Israel or Israel as a nation would break the covenant with God. In verse 11 of Zechariah chapter 11, it says, and it was broken in that day, and thus the poor of the flock that gave heed unto me knew that it was the word of Jehovah. And I said unto them, if ye think good, give me my hire, and if not, forbear. So they weighed for my hire 30 pieces of silver, and Jehovah said unto me, cast it unto the potter, the goodly price that I was prized at by them. And I took the 30 pieces of silver and cast them unto the potter in the house of Jehovah. Then I cut asunder mine other staff, even bands, that I might break the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. I want to ask you, does all of that sound familiar to you? Where do we read about 30 pieces of silver, and what were the circumstances in which we read about that? We read about those 30 pieces of silver being cast to the potter, the goodly price that I was prized at by them. Where do we read about that and why? What's the setting, the backdrop against which we read about these 30 pieces of silver?
Well, it was the bargain of Judas to deliver Jesus to the scribes and Pharisees.
That's right. And who did he bargain with?
The nation of Israel.
That's right. The leaders of the nation of Israel. Now, what happened when he did that? Was not the covenant with Israel broken? Now, let's notice that. You can read that the Jews as a whole, the nation of Israel as a whole, rejected Christ. We can see in Matthew chapter 23 and in verse 38 when Jesus spoke to them about the temple. He didn't claim that it was God's anymore. We notice earlier in Jesus' preaching, he said, you've defiled the temple of God. You've polluted that. But now he says, this is your temple, and it's left to you desolate. If you'll come further over into the New Testament, that's how it's used in the book of Acts. In Acts chapter 3, look, if you will, at verse 14. In Acts chapter 3, verse 14, Peter said to these Jews, ye denied the holy and righteous one and asked for a murderer to be granted to you and killed the Prince of Life whom God raised from the dead, whereof we are witness. Who's Peter preaching to?
The Jews, Israel.
The nation of the Jews. Particularly the hierarchy of the Jews. Now, notice that the nation of Israel as a whole is not the woman of Revelation chapter 12. And I want to suggest to you, we'll talk about that more, but I want to suggest to you that it's not the church either, because the church did not give birth to the man-child. That ought to be a given. Turn that thing around. Jesus said, upon this rock, I will build my church. the man child gave birth to the church, not the other way around. But now when we talk about this woman, let's talk about it some more. Somebody said, well, if it's not the whole nation of Israel, then who is it? Who is the woman? Turn back with me to Isaiah chapter 1, and we're going to look at a number of these passages that you see on the board. But in Isaiah chapter 1, begin reading with me in verse 5. Isaiah chapter 1, beginning in verse 5. The writer says, why will ye be still stricken, that ye revolt more and more? The whole head is sick, and the whole heart faint. From the sole of the foot, even unto the head, there is no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and fresh stripes. They have not been closed, neither bound up, neither mollified with oil. Your country is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. Your land, strangers devour it in your presence. It is desolate as overthrown by strangers. And the daughter of Zion is left as a booth in a vineyard, as a lodge in a garden of cucumbers, as a besieged city, except Jehovah of hosts had left unto us a very small remnant, we should have been as Sodom, we should have been like unto Gomorrah. Think with me on this point. When did Isaiah prophesy? Well, Randy, you pointed out in this morning's service, about 750 years before Jesus came is when Isaiah was prophesying. What were the circumstances among God's people at the time Isaiah prophesied? Well, they were rebelling against God, were they not? And Isaiah is saying here that look at what we've done. We've been wicked people. And unless God spared a very small remnant, we would have been like Sodom. We would have been like Gomorrah. Well, what do we know about Sodom and Gomorrah?
They were destroyed.
They were destroyed. That's right. But Israel as a nation had rebelled against God, and as a nation was going to be taken into captivity, and as a nation would ultimately be destroyed. But he said, there's this very small remnant. Now, this small remnant, I'm persuaded, is the identification of the woman of Revelation chapter 12, not the nation of Israel as a whole. You say, well, Mick, why do you think that? Well, turn with me and let's see the language that's used in Micah chapter 4. Micah chapter 4.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Isn't the name Israel often used in both the Old Testament and the New Testament to indicate those who remain faithful to God?
Sometimes it's used that way in the Old Testament. Not always, I don't think, because there was the larger portion of Israel was going to be destroyed. Now, maybe you're thinking about a point that I want to make in this lesson, and that is in Galatians chapter 6 and verse 16, the Apostle Paul identified the church as the Israel of God. Now, we're going to see that this woman, I think, though it starts out talking about God's faithful remnant of Israel, those who kept God's law, Deuteronomy 30, verses 1 through 8, it eventually implies those who make up the body of Christ. Now, we're going to look at that and try to develop that, J.D., and I think that's maybe where you're pointed with this, and if that be so, that's correct. Because there in not only Galatians 6, but Romans chapter 2, we see that same thought presented, that God's Israel, God's Jew today are those who make up the body of Christ. Now in Micah chapter 4, let's do some reading beginning in verse 9. Micah chapter 4, verse 9. And I really want to call your attention to the language. In verse 9, Micah writes, now, why dost thou cry out aloud? Is there no king in thee? Is thy counselor perished, that pangs have taken hold of thee as of a woman in travail? Be in pain and labor to bring forth, O daughter of Zion, like a woman in travail. For now shalt thou go forth out of the city, and shall dwell in the field, and shall come even unto Babylon. There shall shalt thou be rescued. There will Jehovah redeem thee from the hand of thine enemies. And now many nations are assembled against thee that say, let her be defiled and let our eyes see our desire upon Zion. But they know not the thoughts of Jehovah, neither understand they his counsel. For he hath gathered them as the sheaves of the threshing floor. Arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion, for I will make thy horn iron, and I will make thy hooves brass, and thou shalt beat in pieces many peoples, and I will devote their gain unto Jehovah, and their substance unto the Lord of the whole earth. Now shalt thou gather thyself in troops, O daughter of troops. He hath laid siege against us. They shall smite the judge of Israel with a rod upon the cheek. But thou, Bethlehem Ephrathah, which art little to be among the thousands of Judah, out of thee shall come forth unto me, or shall one come forth unto me, that is to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth are from of old, from everlasting. Therefore will he give them up until the time that she who travaileth hath brought forth. Then the residue of his brethren shall return unto the children of Israel. Now let's pause there in the reading of that. In this passage, you'll note that there is going to be some brought forth from a woman in travail. Who's he talking about in this context of Micah chapter 4? What's about to happen to the people of God? Well, they're going to be taken into captivity, but are they all going to be destroyed? No, there's going to be a remnant. You'll notice in the second chapter of the book of Micah in verse 12, I will surely assemble, O Jacob, all of thee. I will surely gather the remnant of Israel. There's going to be a remnant. That remnant is identified in the reading of this text in Micah chapter 4 as the daughter of Zion, those who were faithful to God. What we notice in this then is that this Old Testament passage is clearly identified as messianic. As we can read in Matthew chapter 2 and verse 6, he's talking about the bringing forth of the man child, and who would be the one bringing forth the man child? Those who were living in rebellion against God? Those of the nation of Israel that cried out, crucify him, crucify him. Well, no. This remnant that remained faithful unto God. Notice, if you will, again, I said I wanted to come back to verse 17 in chapter 12, because after the birth of the man child, I'm persuaded that this woman can best be thought of as the spiritual remnant of God's people who continues to be faithful to him. In chapter 12, verse 17, therein the text tells us, and the dragon waxed wroth with the woman and went away to make war with the rest of her seed. Who is that? Well, he tells us that keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus. So we know who this seed is from verse 17 that represent this remnant of people that are faithful in their service to God. Now, in Isaiah, another Old Testament text that comes to play here, and I was talking to someone recently about some of these Old Testament texts that sometimes we read, but we don't see them in the book of Revelation because they're not quoted. They're alluded to in the book of Revelation. I think somebody counted up that there were over 400 Old Testament contexts that are alluded to in the book of Revelation, although not a single one is directly quoted. But you don't have problem recognizing them. For example, in Isaiah chapter 66, reading beginning at verse 4, Isaiah 66, verse 4, there the text tells us, I also will choose their delusions and will bring their fears upon them, because when I called, none did answer. When I spake, they did not hear, but they did that which was evil in mine eyes and chose that wherein I delighted not. Hear the word of Jehovah, ye that tremble at his word. Your brethren that hate you, that cast you out for my name's sake, have said, let Jehovah be glorified, that we may see your joy. But it is they that shall be put to shame. A voice of tumult from the city, a voice from the temple, a voice of Jehovah that rendereth recompense to his enemies. Before she travailed, she brought forth. Before her pain came, she was delivered of a man child. Who hath heard such a thing? Who hath seen such a thing? Shall a land be born in one day? Shall a nation be brought forth at once? For as soon as Zion travailed, she brought forth her children. Shall I bring to the birth and not cause to bring forth? Saith Jehovah, shall I that cause to bring forth shut the womb? Saith Jehovah. Rejoice ye with Jerusalem and be glad for her, all ye that love her. Rejoice for joy with her, all ye that mourn over her, that ye may suck and be satisfied with the breast of her consolations, that ye may milk out and be delighted with the abundance of her glory. For thus saith Jehovah, behold, I will extend peace to her like a river, and the glory of the nations shall like an overflowing stream, and ye shall suck thereof, and shall be borne upon the side, and shall be dangled upon the knees. As one whom his mother comforteth, so will I comfort you, and ye shall be comforted in Jerusalem. And ye shall see it in your heart, shall rejoice, and your bones shall flourish like the tender grass, and the hand of Jehovah shall be known toward his servants, and he will have indignation against his enemies. Now, I know we don't have the time to spend on Isaiah chapter 66 tonight that I would like to, but I would encourage you to go back and read that. What's Isaiah prophesying about concerning the nation born in the day? What nation is he talking about? If you'll read Matthew chapter 21, you'll note that the Jews understood what Jesus said, that the kingdom would be taken away from them and given to a nation bringing forth the fruits thereof. What was that nation?
Judah.
Well, as we develop our study next time, that we'll clearly see. Bruce, I heard your comment, but I didn't hear what you said.
Judah, the nation of Judah.
Well, no, I believe he's identifying the church that started on Pentecost. Going forward, and we'll look at that as we proceed a little further in our next study. We'll see why this nation would be brought forth of a man child and how it would be brought forth in a day. Now, that's an interesting equation. How could a nation be brought forth in a day? Well, it was on that first Pentecost following the resurrection of Christ, and we'll develop that more as we go along next time. We'd invite you to study with us now. I'm going to stop sharing my charts and ask if you have a question. I know I went through a lot of this very hurriedly. And maybe you have a question or a comment that you'd like to make that might clarify some things for us.
You know, Mickey, yes,
I'm sorry, who said?
The reason I was saying Judah, is that not where Jesus came from?
Jesus came from Judah, that's true, but that woman was not Judah.
Yeah.
And the nation that came forth was not Judah. The nation that came forth was the church. And we'll see that as we develop Isaiah next time.
Hey, Nick.
Randy Childs. Well, got Randy and then Denise.
I just was curious about the significance of the sun, the moon, and the crown of 12 stars. I know you mentioned it, but I guess I'm not grasping it. A woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet.
The lightness that was given to her, the brilliancy that was given to her, the illumination, if you please, that was upon her.
Okay. I mean, God is light. I mean, I'm just trying to understand the significance of the sun, the moon, and the stars. They're all, casting forth light.
That's true. So suggesting grandeur.
Yeah, so we're to understand that this woman is clothed with the light of God.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Okay.
Would the 12 stars be the 12 tribes, that this would be the remnant of the 12 tribes represented in this woman?
I don't necessarily think so, and my reason is because of the use of the number 12. In the scriptures or in the book of Revelation, the number 12 is not an exact number. It represents completeness, and multiples of it represent completeness. So I don't think he's identifying necessarily the 12 tribes of Israel.
Mickey?
Yes, James?
No.
Oh, Terry?
Yeah.
Okay, I think I had Denise in there in front of you, Terry. Let me go ahead and get Denise's comment, and I'll come right back to you.
Actually, I was going to ask about the 12 stars as well, because, you know, it always seems to mean Israel. And, you know, but I understand. So thank you.
Okay. No, I don't think that the number 12 stars is specific about the nation of Israel, because then we've got to assign a specific understanding of the sun and the moon. What
right.
would be the distinction of them? I think that it's suggesting the brilliancy of this woman, illumination. I keep looking at James. Terry, you're behind that screen. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think your idea about representing completeness, I would agree with that. I think that actually it would be completeness relative to the woman, in the sense that you're describing the woman as the spiritual remnant. I've used a different phrase for that because of the man-child being born. You think of a child being born. I've used the term the true family of God.
Well, I don't have any problem with that, because
I think the idea of completeness would relate to a term such as the true family of God.
Well, I don't disagree with that. I think you're identifying the same group of people.
I think it's the same group of people. I think that's consistent when you think of who the woman is, describing, you know, who's giving birth, and then later on, who Satan is warring against.
Yes, verse 17.
Yes. I think that is the true family of God.
Yeah.
Because I think what we don't necessarily need to do is to get sidetracked, perhaps, if I can use that word, by some of the symbology in chapter 12, because I think that this chapter becomes fairly easily understood when we see that what's going on is that Satan is trying to devour, so to speak, trying to devour Christ, trying to
yes.
devour the man-child, and he's not successful in devouring the man-child, so then he takes his war to the church.
That's right.
And he's warring against the church. He's not successful in warring against the church. So now he turns his attention to warring against the saints.
Well, yes, and I would identify the saints and the church essentially as the same. Yeah.
Yeah. I think we see that progression in the 12th yeah. chapter.
Well, that's true. Now, one of the things that I'm anxious to study with this class about is not only where this started as we began in Genesis 3:15, but to cite instances throughout Old Testament history where Satan is struggling and struggling and struggling and struggling to defeat God's purpose, and he just can't do it.
Yeah, and you know, Mickey, this so much reminds me, and I don't know if you thought of this, but you remember what Jesus said at the end of the 16th chapter of John when he made that statement that was really both retrospective and somewhat prophetic. Remember when he said, "I have overcome the world."
Yes, and we're going to capitalize on some of those statements that he made toward the end of John, including the statement, "It is finished."
Yes, that he had finished his work on the earth.
Yes, yes, I've got all that in this chapter, so we just need time. If I had about 3 more hours, we could spend it on chapter 12. Well, as we do always, we're not going to close this study without extending an opportunity to those of you who might desire to obey the gospel. If there's someone who understands your need to obey Christ in becoming a Christian, to be baptized into Christ, having confessed your faith, we'd be happy to entertain that and help you in whatever way that we can. maybe there's somebody that would like the prayers of these brethren on your behalf. If we can help you with that, then that's our desire. And if you'll make that known to us, we'll be happy to pray with you and pray for you to that end.